Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2017 Home Education Conference, held in Logan, Utah.
So, I begin with this idea of the whole idea of math trauma. It's interesting because as I travel around, and I am spending a lot of time these days traveling around largely Waldorf schools, because that is my background. I've been teaching at Waldorf schools for 21 years. I just retired actually last March, and now I'm traveling around the world visiting Waldorf schools, and really Waldorf schools aside, just talking to people about mathematics and their experience with mathematics, and perhaps how, I hope, to give some ideas about how perhaps to teach math a little bit better. But it is interesting that wherever I go in the world, I do encounter people who just mentioning the word mathematics, immediately their face can kind of go blank, and you can just tell that there's this past stuff that comes up for them. And if I ask the question, and maybe you could ask the question yourself, where do you think this math trauma comes from? Where do you think the math trauma comes from? From when you were a child, but what is the root cause of that, might you say, yes?
Being required to do it, okay. Ad nauseum.
Absolutely, so oftentimes it is being required to do something that, in many cases, it depends on the student. I don't want to pretend that all students have this adverse relationship to mathematics. There are certainly many students who enjoy it, seemingly no matter how it's taught, because it is a wonderful subject, honestly. But certainly for many students, you're right, for many students to be required to do something that they don't want to do is certainly part of it that makes it very unpleasant for them. Anything else? What would you add to that? What else would you say causes? We're going to look at the causes first and then talk a little bit about other aspects. I'm going to try to flip it on its head and say, what can we do to make it the opposite thereof? What's that?
Hard to see the application.
I would probably go and say, probably tagging on to that idea, going beyond just hard to see applications of it, but this idea that for many students, it appears to be very meaningless. It's like, why, you know, this ultimate question that you hear often, why is it that you hear students say this, why do we have to study this? Why do we have to study this? And to be honest, it's a fair question, because many times as they're plowing through, turning pages in some textbook or workbook that they really have no relationship to, they're left with this feeling that this seems very meaningless. And so that's certainly a word that I like to use a lot, because in my mind, math, unfortunately, has become meaningless for many students. Anything else that you would add that might contribute to math trauma? Yeah. Absolutely. For some students, it's being in this sort of perpetual state of frustration and not really feeling that they get to. I think a lot of that frustration, honestly, is based on this lack of understanding of what they're doing. They don't have a strong sense of understanding. Yeah. Absolutely. So using the example of algebra and the quadratic formula, and I completely agree with that, because oftentimes it is presented to students, it's just given to them. Here's the formula, and I'm going to give you an example of this in a little bit, of a formula that often is just given to students, that instead what we want to do in the quadratic formula, and which is, if you're not familiar with that, that's a highlight. It should be the highlight of any Algebra 1 course. Right? And why should it be a highlight? It should be a highlight not just because the teacher went up on the board and just wrote it down and said, here it is and let's use it. And for students like you saying, why? Where did that come from? You absolutely should wonder that, and you should demand, any student should demand, where did that come from? And better yet, it should be that any student has an experience, especially with something as wonderful as that, they should experience discovering it for themselves. This is the essence of mathematics. Ask yourself that question. What is the essence of mathematics? And what it ends up being for many students, well, what is mathematics? really? Well, it's all these procedures that I'm just expected to memorize. The teacher just gave them to me. A formula really is a type of procedure, isn't it? It gives you instructions of what to do, right? Put values in the case of the quadratic formula, put values in for A, B, and C, and do this calculation as the instructions, as the formula instructs you to do, and it spits out an answer, right? But what we want to do is we want to transform mathematics so that actually mathematics is a process of discovery. You could look up online, perhaps, a guy named Paul Lockhart. Paul Lockhart wrote an essay in a mathematics journal, I want to say it was about 10 years ago, and it was titled Mathematician's Lament. Has anyone heard of that? Mathematician's Lament. It's an excellent essay. It's now been published as a book. You can go and it's been enlarged for a book, but the original essay was actually nice and short and concise. And I love that essay because he's really questioning our society's view of mathematics. And one of my favorite quotes from Paul Lockhart in that essay, he says, "Math is not a language." How often do you hear people say math is a language? And he says, no, math is not a language. Algebra is a language, that's true. Algebra is a language to express mathematical thoughts, that much is true. But math itself is not a language. We hear people say, oh, the purpose of math is so that you can study this language and learn this stuff, so that then you can apply it to something interesting later in life. Like maybe you'll be a banker or an accountant, or maybe you'll be an engineer. But the purpose of math really is to someday in your distant future, which of course, to be honest, hardly any kid can really even imagine what that would be like, you know, 20 years in the future, they're somehow going to use this math for something. Someday it will get interesting. And this is a terrible thing to tell our students, that someday you'll find a use for this, someday in the distant future. He says math is not a language, it's an adventure. Isn't that an interesting thought? Math is not, it's an adventure. And so it should be. So it should be. And what's an adventure? Ask yourself that. What makes something an adventure? Is it an adventure to just go and be given instructions of what to do? I don't think so. There's uncertainty in adventure, isn't there? There's the unknown. There's struggle. There's all these things. It's life. Isn't that what math should be? Math should be about life. It shouldn't be about this recipe that you kind of like, it's like going to see a movie and you know, or reading a book, and you're told the plot. Who would want to do that? Who would want to know the exact outcome before you ever started? Math isn't like that. Math, there's uncertainty in math. Are we comfortable with uncertainty in our world today? I don't think so. Right? But math in its very nature has this uncertain quality. You look at a problem and you don't know. With real math, you don't know what to do. In fact, the scary thing is you're not sure if you actually can be successful and get the problem right. That's part of the adventure. Now, the art of the teacher, honestly, for all of us as teachers, the art of the teacher is knowing what adventures to send our children out on. We don't want to, for a fourth grader, say, I'll use the example of the quadratic formula again, we're not going to tell a fourth grader, well, just go out and discover the quadratic formula. Good luck. Right? That's not going to work. First of all, it's not an appropriate time to bring it. And secondly, we do have to give some guidance on this adventure that our students are on. So let me get back to this idea of more causes, perhaps, of this math trauma. I would say part of the trauma is that we are overwhelmed. And it's not just, and when I say we, I mean the teachers. Aren't we overwhelmed with this tremendous list of stuff that we feel that we need to get through? Have you ever felt that? Have you ever felt that? It's like, and that's what another favorite author of mine, and his name is Peter Taylor from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. He talks about the terror of the list. What does that mean, the terror of the list? Because as teachers, we're given this impression, somehow, this unconscious impression, that we have a tremendous amount of material, amount of stuff to get through. And there's this huge list, and we just go through and we check things off the list. And our goal is to somehow get through this list by the end of the year, and the only way to do that is to move really quickly. I think that's part of the trauma. Do you remember feeling that things move just way too quickly? right? And oftentimes in school, there's an advanced class and a non-advanced class or remedial class or regular class or whatever you want to call it, and the advanced class gets to move faster. What's the point? I'd like to know this. What's the point of just moving very quickly through a list? And I would say this adds to our meaninglessness, or this feeling of meaninglessness of math. The point is not just to get through a lot of stuff. We need to, sometimes we may move a little bit quickly, but at other times we need to go into depth. We need to slow down, take our time, and allow for this depth of understanding, and allow for the adventure to unfold. Because adventures also typically aren't on a clock. And so we need to allow for these opportunities to unfold so that students can actually feel successful. Let me get back to this idea of success in a moment. So I guess another thing I would say is there's this sense of math being a competition. Is that true? Is that true? Math can be very competitive. The whole idea, in fact, this happens. I will give, and I'll even do this with adults. Right? In fact, I'll give you a puzzle to think about in a little bit here. Yeah. And what happens is this. Immediately, there's this sense with some people in the room, ooh, let's see if I can be first. Let's see if I can get the answer first. Math in its nature should not be competitive. It's not really a contest to see who can get the answer the fastest, to see who can make the least mistakes, to see who can get, because that's not really what it's all about. Math should be, as I said before, about life, about us being human beings, and about improvement. Wherever you are, your goal as a student should be to raise yourself up and to become better. And in fact, this is an interesting term. I'm sure you've heard this term before. When this term was coined, leave no child behind, no child left behind, that whole thing. If you really, that was a very interesting, I don't think it was intentional, maybe it was, but didn't that term alone spark a lot of fear in people? I think it did, because suddenly it seems collectively all parents turned around and said, oh my God, is my child behind? Right? They may not even have thought of it before. And I asked the question, behind what? What are they behind? It's a very interesting thing. I've heard some teachers say the whole class is behind. That's a very strange thing, everyone's behind. What are they behind? And then it also lends itself to this feeling, this bizarre feeling somehow, that no one should be behind anybody else, which gives the impression that everyone should be at the same place all the time, that everyone should be equal. And it's not like that. It's not. And it's okay if some children are a little bit more advanced, a little quicker, and some children struggle a little bit more. This isn't, our goal is not to have, is it? It shouldn't be as teachers, to have everybody become the same. And so a teacher or a parent comes up to me and says, what do I do with my child? My child is struggling with math. And what's my response? When I hear someone say my child struggles with math, my response is, oh, that is a wonderful thing. Because you now have the possibility for the greatest success. Now, to be honest, that's not necessarily an answer that many parents would want to hear. But honestly, struggle is a good thing. It's an essential part of mathematics. It's an essential part of doing math. I want all of my students to struggle. Let me say that. And I mean that seriously. I tell my students this all the time. I want all of my students to struggle. Why? Because that's part of the greatest success. What is true success in mathematics? It's when you encounter something, and it's not just math, is it? Isn't it many things in life? When do you feel most successful? Even in a sport. If you're doing a sport, when do you feel most successful? It's not when you just went out there and you beat somebody who was far beneath you and it was easy. That's not success, is it? Success is when you did something that you didn't think you could do. And in mathematics, what does that look like? It looks like for a student, they look at something and they think, that looks really difficult and challenging. I'm not sure if I can do it. I don't think I can. And then as a parent, what can we do? We can guide our students, we can guide our child, help them out along this path, along this adventurous path, and then suddenly they experience success where they didn't think they could have it. That's true success. So I think that's one of our goals as well, is to really define what success is. I think there are titles of books out there somewhere. There was this whole series of books about making something easy. Have you ever heard of the making math easy? Right? That's not what it's about. Sometimes we get the impression that our task as teachers is to make it easy for our students. And again, I differ with that. Our task as teachers is to find the right material to, part of our task is to find the right material to bring to our students at that right level of difficulty. Sometimes maybe we do want to make it a little bit easy, especially when we introduce something. But oftentimes we want to actually give something that's really challenging and then help them to overcome that, because again, that's the most success. I think part of this, and maybe this goes hand in hand with this trauma, is this fear. And I think that's one of the things we need to do as parents. We need to identify the fear within ourselves, oftentimes. And sometimes that fear is associated with our own past math trauma, isn't it? Or in some cases, it could be. It's interesting, I've noticed as a teacher, that some of the parents that are most fearful are those parents who have been very successful in math themselves. I had a class once where the class collectively, there seemed to be a lot of fear among the parents. I gathered the parents together, and then I found out that most of the parents were either scientists or engineers, and they were fearful that their own child wasn't going to be successful in life because of their own math weaknesses. And so I think fear and the stress associated with all of that, we need to find ways to address that. And I think one of the best ways to do that is just to redefine really what success is for our children. Is our goal simply just to get our students as advanced as we can and get them ahead? These things go hand in hand. Leave no child behind, and I want to get my child ahead. Ahead of what? Is it a contest? It shouldn't be. The goal should not to be just to get ahead as quickly as possible. When we fall into that, what happens? Coming back to that thing I mentioned earlier, things like the quadratic formula end up introduced too early in this name of getting ahead. And if we want to have our children successful, oftentimes in our society that success seems to be defined by this notion of being ahead. And being ahead, of course, means doing things at a younger and younger age. And when we do things too young for the students to understand, guess what? We're probably just going to write formulas on the board because we don't think that they're ready to understand it, and they probably aren't. So that's one of the things we can do to really avoid math trauma, is make sure that, and this is a very Waldorf idea, is we wait until they're ready to understand it deeply. Okay. I did want to mention, let me reiterate that thing that I just spoke about briefly. And that is, I think there are two basic problems that often can manifest when teaching math. One is that we're not explaining things clearly. And you may remember, can you remember a time when you had a math teacher that was explaining something and it didn't make sense? Right? That's the thing that we often think about. If we're not being successful as teachers, we're not explaining it clearly. And I want to also mention the other end. I had a student once, and I'll say this, and the student left our school and went to another school for high school. And I saw this student, this girl, she was extremely bright. And I asked her, when I saw her some 6 months later or so, I said, "How's school going?" She said, "It's okay." And I said, "Well, how's math?" Because I knew the math teacher that she had, and I knew that he was a very respected math teacher. And I was very surprised at her answer. She said, "Oh, I don't really like math that much." And I said, "Why?" And you know what she said? It was a very interesting insight she had. She said, "I don't like it because he answers all my questions before I have them. He answers all my questions before I have them." This was a teacher that was very experienced, who knew all the questions that could possibly arise, all the pitfalls, right? All the stumbling blocks for the students. And so this teacher made sure, steered around that to make sure that there were no bumps in the road, there was no struggle, that things were easy. And this student recognized somehow, I thought that was very insightful of her, that I don't have any questions because he answers them all before I have them. And so this is an important thing. I'll talk about this at another lecture later. Actually, no, later in this one here, I'll tie into this. This idea of making sure that we're working actively with the students' questions, because that's so important. Let me come back to that in a moment. All right. Let me give an example of this idea of teaching math in a way so that we're not just giving it to them, so that they can discover something. Do you have any idea what this is going to be a discovery of? Have you seen this before? What are we going to discover? Ah, I'll leave that as a surprise to you then if you don't know. Excellent, very good. This is an exercise I do in eighth grade. I think this is a perfect time to do it. And again, from a Waldorf perspective, we always ask the question, when is the best time developmentally for me to do it? Not how soon can I do it and how young can I do it. This is eighth grade. And again, you don't know what it is yet. You will see. So what I have them do, this is a very hands-on activity. And believe me, I'll put that out there as a thought. Sometimes people think, oh, math should be hands-on to actually be good. And sometimes it should be. And this is an example of when having it hands-on really works. But it's a misconception to think that math, to be good, needs to be hands-on all the time. But here's a good one. So I have them actually cut out four circles, right? And or I'll have them make four circles. Let's do this. I'll have them make four circles. And in the first circle, we'll cut it into four pieces, pie pieces, and they do it pretty exactly. So they do this with a compass. All the circles are the exact same size. Let's just say we'll have them be 2 inches in radius, all of them. All right? And what I'll have them do is they'll shade in the outside, the circumference of the circle with a colored pencil, and then they'll cut out the pieces of each of the, we'll just cut out the first three circles. The first circle is cut into four pieces, second one, eight, the third one into 16 pieces. And then I have them cut it out, and I have them arrange these pie pieces in a way so that the first piece has, we'll say, the tip down, and then the second one tip up, and they're side by side. And what do we get? Then we'll get something that looks like this. See if this makes sense. It's not drawn perfectly, but here we have the four pieces side by side, right? First piece, tip down, next piece, tip down, tip up. And yeah, that's the shape you get. How's that gonna look different with the second one when we cut that out? Can you see what's gonna happen? So the second one's gonna look like this. And you can do this, and again, I highly recommend doing this with the students. And then we get this. And how about the next one? 16 pieces. Not making this perfect, that's difficult to do. And we get something like this. So what's happening as we make more and more pieces? Do you see what's happening? So we can say that, I almost picture this as kind of like going along a road, and it's like a cobblestone street, and here the bumps are really big with the first one. And the second one, as we go, as we have more and more pieces, the bumps become more numerous. That third circle had 8 bumps at the top, right? The second circle had 4 bumps at the top. First circle had just 2 bumps. So the bumps become more numerous, but less of a big deal. If you were biking along, I have this memory of being in Portugal, biking along a cobblestone street, and it was just so unpleasant because the bumps were so big. If you had more stones with little smaller bumps, you wouldn't notice them as much. What's the fourth circle supposed to be? Do you know where I'm going on this? What do you think I'm going to do? I could go to 32, could go to 64, I could keep going like that. But I want the students to imagine, and this is why it's an eighth grade thing, I want them in their imagination, and imagination is so important. It's an important part of mathematics. Strange thought. Do you feel that math is imaginative and creative? It should be. In its nature, it absolutely is. The way it's taught, sadly, often isn't. And certainly the way it's manifested in our textbooks, that becomes a problem. This last circle here, I am going to imaginatively cut it into infinitely many, infinitely thin strips, infinitely thin pieces. Can you imagine me doing this? Not 32 pieces or 64, but infinitely many. If I could do that, could you imagine then making this last one? What would it look like? Can you see? Can you picture it? What would it be? It would be an exact rectangle. And all these, we'd have tip up, tip down, just like that, but they'd be so thin, infinitely thin, namely. And so what I have, and in fact, now what I have on the board are eight figures, aren't they? Four of them on the left are circles. The four of them on the right are just the same circles, just cut out and made into different arrangements. All eight of these figures are what? They have the same area, don't they? What am I doing? I'm showing you the formula for the area of a circle. That's what this is. Is that a surprise to you? Maybe, maybe not. Right? So let's go back to that. Let's go and look at this. All of them. I'm most concerned about this rectangle that I created. Can you tell me what the height of that rectangle is? Well, it was the radius of the circle. And didn't we say the radius of the circle is 2 inches? Now, let's look at the circumference of all the circles. What is the circumference of the circle? Well, the diameter of the circle was what? What was the diameter? It was 4 inches, wasn't it? And we know that the circumference of a circle is the diameter times pi, and so I'll call that 4 pi. And now you see why I did color. That color on the outside actually served a real purpose. Do you see why? Because if I look at the circumference of the circle, which was in color, right, what about the top of the rectangle? That's half the circumference, isn't it? Because half of it's up here and half of it's down there. So what's half of 4 pi going to be? It's going to be 2 pi. And so therefore, the area of this rectangle, we know the area of a rectangle, that's easy. That's just the height times the length. And so what is it going to be? The area is simply going to be 2 times 2 pi. So it's the height times the length. 2 times 2 pi, which is equal to 4 pi square inches. You can write it like that. And again, for eighth graders, they can really fall. And I'm amazed and quite pleased with the fact that even the students that struggle the most, and this is a huge misconception. Can I say this? This is a huge misconception. That if a student is weak at skills, then they're also weak in their mathematical thinking. And that's not true. There are plenty of students out there that have weak skills for whatever reason, who are traumatized by the skills work in math, who can actually follow the thinking. They can follow this, and it's satisfying because guess what? I didn't just give them the formula. Now, this last step is a little bit harder because I just come back and I say, okay, now let's, instead of saying that the radius, imagine that the radius wasn't 2, but the radius was just r. If that radius is r instead, what's the diameter? It's 2r, it's twice as much, and then we multiply that times pi, and so we get usually how it's written is 2 pi r. So the whole circumference of the circle is 2 pi r. And notice I didn't just memorize that as a formula. And then now I can look at this. Now, what's the height of that rectangle? Well, it's the same as the radius of the circle, so that's r. And what's half the circumference now? Well, what's half of 2 pi r? Well, half of 2 pi r is just 1 pi r. So I'll write that down as pi r. And now, what is the area of this rectangle? Well, that's just going to be r times pi r. And we know r times, so I'll just write that as r times pi r. I could rearrange things if I wish, and I do. And I'll put the pi out in front, so it's pi times r times r. And this is exactly how I'd explain it with the eighth graders. And then r times r, just like 7 times 7, I can write as 7 squared, r times r. I can just write as r squared, and there we have it. What's the disadvantage? So what did I do? I actually led the students through a process of discovery. And some of the more advanced students, they actually, you know, I give them a chance to do this on their own, and then I explain it at the board. And so some of the students discovered it for themselves. Others of them heard my explanation. But no matter what, this formula didn't just randomly get pulled out of the hat. Do you ever get the feeling math is like that? It's like, for a student, it's just like, where did this come from? It's a sad thing when something random can appear in a book. It's just some random topic, and here's a formula, and a student, and they should ask, well, where did that come from? Because the reality is, where did it come from? It was just on the next page, right? But it should come from somewhere. It should come from a deep question that lived within the students for a while. Let me say that. this question, there was a question here. What was the question? I gave them this question ahead of time. Instead of it just being the next page, they knew it was coming. When did I give them this question? A year earlier. Do you see the power of that? I tell them in seventh grade, I said, next year you will discover the formula of how to calculate the area of a circle. And they wait. And then we get there. And I said, remember last year when I told you this? And they remember it. And then we come and we go through this whole thing. Now it seems that math has real purpose and meaningfulness. Do you see? It didn't just appear randomly. There was purpose and intention. It was a question that lived with them into some degree. I planted it as a teacher. And then we finally got there and we answered it. And then it felt like there was a purpose behind what we were doing. It wasn't just a random thing on a list. Yeah? So I wanted to share with you this idea of mathematical discovery. This is what I'd like to do now. I have three goals here. We'll see if we can do this before the end. I want to talk a little bit about what it takes to be a good math teacher. And I might do this in reverse order. I'm going to talk about what I call my core principles for teaching math. And I did want to give you a puzzle, just to leave you with a puzzle at the end, because you should have fun too. I think it's good. Yeah? What do you think of this? Have you seen, how many people saw that have seen this before? Has anyone seen this before? Nobody? Okay, excellent. Isn't that neat? Right? Through their experience, they can actually discover the formula for the area of a circle. Quadratic formula, I actually have them discover the quadratic formula in three different ways in ninth grade. Three different ways. Geometrically, as it was actually done back in the day. Isn't that weird? A geometrical proof of the quadratic formula. I certainly never could have imagined what it looked like. A man named Al-Khwarizmi, who's credited with writing the first ever algebra book. And by the way, that's a good way to help make math meaningful, isn't it? To have our students actually experience math as the greatest minds in history experienced it. Let's go back and see how Al-Khwarizmi discovered the quadratic formula. What a wonderful thing. Let's go and see, how did Archimedes figure out what pi was? He didn't measure it. Of course, the students should measure, shouldn't they? Shouldn't the students discover pi for themselves? How would you do that? You'd measure the circumference of many circles and diameters, and you'd divide, and you'd see what the ratio was. Do 10 different circles. Have your child go out there and measure 10 different circles. And in each case, of course, you have to do a whole lot of preparation to get there because you have to talk about really what do ratios mean. Because in essence, pi is not just a number 3.14. It's a ratio. It's fascinating. And then after you do all that, you say, well, how did Archimedes actually figure out what pi was to such huge accuracy without measuring? It's a wonderful question. Have them live with that question again for a long time, and then eventually say, okay, now it's time for us to, maybe together, if you're homeschooling as parents, together with the child, you can sit down and look at Archimedes' original work and see how he did it. That's amazing. That's 10th grade. It's advanced, but it's amazing if you can get there. So it's this whole idea of discovering. How about, let me talk about a younger grade. Right? How about this whole idea of you're in second grade and you're trying to get them to know the tables? Are you having them discover the tables for themselves? Like imagine the sevens table, 7, 14, 21, 28. Right? They should discover that for themselves and feel a huge sense of accomplishment. Fourth grade, have them discover long division and how it works for themselves. You don't just give it to them, you discover it. I'm going to do that in another lecture later, I think tomorrow. Right? I'll show you how you can discover the process for long division. It's really wonderful. All right, let me get to my core principles now. So somebody, I came up with this idea of thinking, when I give a lecture, maybe I ought to share after 32 years of teaching. Maybe I have hopefully a little tiny bit of wisdom to share with people about what have I learned. Or I can imagine myself, if I were new to teaching math, or in most of your cases, if you're homeschooling and you're really going through this journey for the first time, what is it that I have to share with you that I feel like I've learned that I didn't know in the beginning? And so these are what I call my core principles, and I have six of them. So I'm going to enumerate these six principles. Thank you. I'm going to enumerate these six principles, each of them, And maybe this will be, maybe you'll walk away hopefully with a thought that might be a little bit new here that would be helpful. Isn't that why you come to any conference? You know, probably a lot of the things you hear, it's like, yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah, I've heard that before. But there's just a couple of new things that you walk away with that really change how you do things. That makes it worthwhile. Yeah, so maybe you'll come up with one new thing that I say that's nice. That's what I hope, right? So I have six things in my list of these core principles that I'm going to share with you. First up here is what I call the three-year plan. What is a three-year plan? So what do I mean by the three-year plan? It's this. I used to have the idea that whenever I taught something in math, my goal was, here's a new topic. And the goal was with my students, I'm teaching you this, and I'm going to explain it well, and you're going to practice, and then you're going to get good at it, and then I'm going to test you on it. If I'm successful, then you'll be successful, and at the end of this little block of time, you'll have learned this thing really well. And I slowly came to the realization that that's really not very helpful. It's not realistic. Let me use the example of fourth grade fractions. This is when I advocate for introducing fractions. It belongs, and this is a very Waldorf idea, that we ask, when does it developmentally best to do it? And in my mind, fourth grade is it. We introduce fractions in fourth grade. Whenever you introduce it, right? Here's the misconception that many people have. Like, oh, we're doing fractions this year. What's my goal? I want them to become really good at fractions. And that, to me, is not the best way to look at it. I got 3 years. If I'm introducing fractions in fourth grade, I'm thinking, okay, I'm introducing it now. I want to introduce it really thoroughly, give them a really good foundation. I want them to understand the essence of what a fraction is. I might have them practice a tiny bit of fractions, but I'm not concerned at all if they're good at fractions by the end of this year at all. Because I know I've got 3 years. My goal is by the end of sixth grade, they're going to be good with fractions. Does that seem like a lot of time? It does. And yet, what do I see time and time again? I see students who the teacher had this idea that, oh, they're going to be good at fractions in fourth grade. Guess what happened? They did way too much practice early, too early. They were just introduced to it, and they're practicing fractions all the time. And what happens? After a while, they drown in it, and then they leave fourth grade not liking fractions at all. And that becomes a problem. How many students out there hate fractions? Isn't that a common thing? How many students come into seventh grade, come into high school, and they still hate fractions? This is a problem. So what I advocate for is when you introduce it, you keep it simple. You keep it deep at the same time so they understand the essence of what it is, and they leave fourth grade saying, I love fractions and I'm good at it. They think they're good at it even if they haven't done much. Then what do you do in fifth grade, second year? What do? You then practice it more. You start practicing it, right? You're still thinking, yeah, maybe they'll be pretty good at it, but it's okay if they're not quite there yet. My goal, again, is the end of sixth grade. The end of the third year, that's when I want their skills to be strong. And that's it. That's a three-year plan. And I just gave the example with fractions, but it would be the same thing, for instance, with long division, with percents. I introduced percents in sixth grade, and I'm thinking at the end of eighth grade, I want them to be good. When I say 3 years, sometimes I think it should be three steps, right? But I'm really thinking of this long period of time. In high school, I introduced trigonometry in 10th grade, and I want them to be good by 12th grade. That's what I'm really, and this three-year plan really helped me a lot. Okay, next, second thing. There's more to math than just skills. Yeah? There's more to math than just skills. And so I want to separate this out between skills. What's the other thing? I'm going to call it mathematical experiences. What do I mean by mathematical experiences? I just gave you a mathematical experience. Discovery. Coming up with the area of a circle. That's a mathematical experience. Sometimes a mathematical experience is perhaps looking at historically how something came about. That's a mathematical experience. Sometimes it's a mathematical experience as a student sitting there and watching your teacher model mathematical thinking for you. Mathematical experiences lead to mathematical thinking. And that's what's neglected. If I ask the question, what percentage of the time in a math classroom typically is focused on skills? I think the answer is 99%. Usually it's all skills. And what I'm saying is what we want to really have is, here's my goal as a teacher overall, loosely. I want to really minimize how much time I'm spending on skills. I want it to be about 50%, and I want to leave 50% of the time for mathematical experiences. Some of this is gray, can I say that? Some of it's a little bit of a gray area, right? Because sometimes I'm leading through discovery and that's helping their skills, so it's a little bit of each. But I really want to see if I really want to make sure I'm not doing too much skills, because I want to develop the mathematical thinking. Next on my list, avoiding blind procedures. This is the major thing that I go around and tell everybody about. We already heard a couple of examples already. When I go and just tell my students, oh, formula for the area of a circle, that's what we're doing today. We're doing the formula for the area of a circle. A equals pi r squared. Now you do a couple of problems. Here's how to do one problem. You do 50 for homework and I'll give you a test. Right? That's just blind procedures. Didn't come out of any understanding, did it? This was, is it a procedure? When my students discover the formula for an area of a circle, and then they eventually do practice some of those, and one of those problems appears on a test, is it a procedure? Yeah, of course it is. It's still a procedure, but it's not blind because I know where it came from. There was understanding. So that's what I mean by a blind. Blind procedure is a procedure that was just handed to them without understanding. So we at least, do we have to do procedures in math? A fair bit. Are they way overdone? Yes. We do way too many procedures in our math classes typically. And again, that's me talking about most skills are procedures based. Skills, procedures are okay, yeah, within a certain dose of them, but not too much. So we want to make sure that what procedures we're teaching aren't just blind, right? That there's understanding behind it. Next on my list is, and this is the core of Waldorf education, is I want it to be developmentally appropriate. So I'm not doing algebra in fifth grade. Right? To me, there's a developmentally best time for anything to be taught. And in this world today where everything seems to be doing things younger and younger and younger, this becomes a problem. In Waldorf schools, as an example, kindergarten is for play. It's not for academics. The academics will come. We want our students to be healthy, and we want them to play. Okay? There's a developmentally appropriate time to do reading, to do anything. And that's key to, in terms of my beliefs, in terms of teaching mathematics. Next on my list, I already spoke about this a little bit, is struggle. I want to transform struggle into success. I want all of my students to struggle. It wouldn't clearly be good if my students only struggled and never experienced success. But I want them to experience struggle, and I want them to work through that struggle and feel successful. And then the last thing, I alluded to this already before, is working with questions. What do I mean by that, working with questions? Well, I already gave a couple of examples, didn't I? I know next year, I'm in seventh grade, and I know next year I'm going to teach the area of a circle, so I'm posing the question to them in seventh grade. That's an extreme, maybe. Oftentimes, I'm saying, okay, this is what we're doing tomorrow, so I want you to think about this question today. Right? Everything comes out of questions. Everything arises out of questions. This is what develops mathematical thinking. Questions are the root of it. Everything, in that way, you could think of it also, these questions are like little puzzles. Math should be about puzzles. Everything should be a puzzle. And I promise two more things. So I want to talk a little bit about what does it take to be a good math teacher, right? Because I know for many, everywhere I go, be it Waldorf schools that are teaching classes of 20-some children or homeschoolers, you know, many teachers feel, oh no, how could I possibly be a good math teacher when I had such a terrible experience with math as a child, right? When I'm math traumatized. And I'll say this, it's not easy. I don't want to pretend that it's easy. But you have the possibility of doing something that's even more profound than what I can do as a teacher. Because for you to share that experience with your child and for you to be modeling for your child how you can overcome your own struggles is hugely valuable. You have the possibility of doing something that's incredibly powerful. And so you can be on this journey with your own child. It takes time. It takes courage. You have to make sure that you're modeling the right thing. What happens when something becomes difficult? You have to be really careful. If you're throwing your hands up and saying, oh, I'm terrible at math, I can't do this, and giving up, that's a problem as an example for your child. If instead what you're saying is, yes, this is difficult for me, I'm frustrated right now, I'm having troubles with this, and then you're spending time, perhaps on your own, working through that struggle, and then you come back the next day and you say, look what I discovered. I wasn't able to do this before, but now I can. Do you see how exciting that can be? And guess what? This is another myth of math. I have these myths of math that I talk about. One of the myths is that if you're good at math, you're fast, and you don't make mistakes. Now, no doubt, there are some people who are good at math who are fast and never seem to make mistakes. But the reality is that you don't have to be fast at math to be good at math. And the reality is, not only is it okay to make mistakes, but making mistakes are an essential part of making math, of doing math. To do math, you want to make lots of mistakes, and you want to learn from them. How are you with making mistakes? Ask yourself that question. Does it bother you when you make a mistake? And when you make a mistake, how are you modeling that for your students? Because to me, when I make a mistake in front of the class, I look at that as a great opportunity for my students to learn from me. How do I handle it? Right? If I clearly am embarrassed and feel inadequate because I just made a mistake, that's not modeling it very well. Right? I love to make mistakes and have my students, and the most wonderful thing, and this can be vulnerable, but I can tell you for sure, some of my best lessons are when suddenly I didn't understand what was going on. In front of my students, I was like, wait, what's going on here? There's something wrong, and I don't know the answer. I'm showing them, for one, that I'm human, but I'm also showing them an essential part of math. Math is when you encounter difficulties, roadblocks, challenges, you made a mistake, you don't know what to do, and then suddenly me and my students are doing math together. As a homeschooling parent, you have the opportunity to be doing math with your child, and part of doing math is making mistakes and working through difficulties. So, can you be good at teaching math? Absolutely. It's not easy. I don't want to say that it's easy. And let's get rid of this weird notion that somehow math is this emotionless subject. That if you were good at math, there would be no emotions. I can't say that math is fun. There are times when perhaps it is. But when I'm really doing math, and what I mean by doing math is I'm struggling with something, I'm stuck, I'm not happy. I'm annoyed. There's a little bit of an edge there. Don't talk to me, I'm doing math. You know what I mean? Right? But it's a wonderful feeling of joy when I work through that and I'm successful. I'm like, yes, now I've got the answer. Then I'm happy. Right? But the process of doing math, it's not all fun. Right? So I say that because, yeah, this notion of somehow we have to make math fun, sometimes it will be, but I don't want that to be the major goal. Because it's not always fun. Sometimes it's hard work. Sometimes it is annoying. Yes, we have to work through struggle. Confusion. Who thinks that it's bad to be confused? You hear that all the time from students. I'm confused. Yeah, no kidding. How can you possibly do math without being confused? You can't. Some students are so unbothered by being confused that they don't even notice they're confused. It doesn't bother them at all. And then some students, maybe some people in this room, when they're confused, it really bothers them a lot. It pushes their buttons. So acknowledge that if that's you. It's okay to be confused. It's part of doing math. Great. I have time for a puzzle. Here's the puzzle. You ready? It's a good one. So, a puzzle for you all. Here it is. You walk up to a bridge. You're in a group of four people, right? And I'll say person A, B, C, and D. So person A, yeah, four people walk up to the bridge. The goal is to get across the bridge. It's in the middle of the night. It's dark. It's a dangerous bridge. You can only have one person across at a time. You know that whole story, right? They have a flashlight. You can't go across the bridge unless you have a flashlight, because there are like holes in the bridge and you'll fall down to your doom through into the gorge and all that. Right? Two people at a time can go across the bridge. So this is what's going to happen. You have to get everybody across. So clearly, this is true. Two people will go across, one person will bring the flashlight back. Two people go across, one person bring the flashlight back. Two people go across, one person bring the flashlight. Did I? That was it. Anyway, you get the idea. When they're all across the other side, that's... So the question is this. How quickly can you get everyone across if person A takes 1 minute to go across if they were going on their own? Person B takes 2 minutes to go across if they were going on their own. Person C takes 5 minutes, 1, 2, 5, and then the last person takes 10. Obviously, if they're going across together, they're holding hands, carrying the flashlight, and how fast are they going? The rate of the slower person. Does that make sense? So if person 2 and 10 are going together, they're going to take 10 minutes to get across, right? Does that make sense? Do you understand the question? The question is, what's the least amount of time you can get across the bridge? Yeah? So we're doing math. Did anybody tell you how to do this problem before? Has anyone seen the problem before? You have? Let's try it. See what you get. Just give you a few minutes.
Can you give the times?
1, 2, 5, and 10 minutes. 1, 2, 5, 10 minutes. There are no tricks to this. There's nothing. I don't like puzzles that have weird little unexpected annoying tricks. There's nothing like that. Waldorf students are very creative. Some creative students will say, well, can I build a catapult and send them across? Or can we throw the flashlight across? There's nothing weird like that. It's literally two people across, one person brings a flashlight back, two people across. So the question is, maybe reframe that a little bit. Once they get older, how can they really see that math has purposefulness in it?
Yeah.
I would use this as an example. There are times when I want math to be something that is clearly applicable to the everyday world and have that sort of purpose. Practical math, you could say. But I would absolutely make the statement that without a doubt that the best math I have taught, the best lessons, the most amazing stuff, is all completely useless. It's just amazing stuff. You know, it's like Archimedes figuring out the value for pi. You know, it's an incredible thing to do that. Number bases are so fascinating. Now you could say, I mean, there is a lot of math that has some sort of application somewhere, but when the kids are engaged in wonderful and meaningful and challenging math and they're into it, they don't ask, why am I using this? They usually ask that question when it's really dull and boring. And if I'm bringing them really interesting material, even if it's useless, and again, I don't mean all math should be useless, but I try to, whenever I want to make it practical, I want to make sure that it's something that is really good. Like in eighth grade, I'll go and we'll measure the speed of sound. I mean, that's just cool, right? But it's a big thing. It's not like word problems sometimes are sold to us as, oh, this is practical math. It's not. It's a complete lie. Word problems are not all they're cracked up to be. They're mostly silly, annoying things. Yeah. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do any word problems, but we need to make sure we package them and be honest. This is not what engineers do with their lives. They don't sit around doing these word problems that you're looking at right now. It just doesn't happen. All right. Raise your hand if you got 19. Nice. Why do I like this problem so much?
There's more than one answer.
No, there's one answer because there's a minimum time. There's certainly a minimum time to it. And the reason why I love this problem is most every time, did anybody get less than 19? Yes? Very good. What'd you get?
17.
Very good. So for the rest of you is to figure out what he did. Because the answer isn't 19. That was good that you got that. Most everyone, including me, when that problem was first given to me, get 19. Right? And so this is the question for you, now that you thought it was 19 and it's not. Is that annoying? I think it's annoying. I thought, a student gave that to me in front of the class. It was really embarrassing. That wasn't embarrassing. It was just annoying. And I'm like, it's 19. No, it's not, Mr. York. It's not 19. And that was really annoying. But I got determined. I really wanted to know. And I hope you're determined as well. and that's your homework, is to figure out how can you get 17 out of that. It's a really good, and there's no trick. It's possible. But anyway, thank you very much. If anybody has questions, you can come up and talk to me and ask questions. I'll also be in the vending hall over there. Thank you for coming.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.